That was the whole point of the book, was to show what it's really like. It's not all Shark Tank and parties. It's possible to build something with some balance in your life. It was this very out-of-body thing to be in the cab and going, God, I don't need to work again if I don't want to, but it's amazing.
This is Hong from Fun BMC, and I'm super excited about episode 3. We have a huge guest today. I have with us Mark Randolph, the co-founder and CEO of Netflix, founding CEO of Netflix. Mark, thank you very much for coming on.
Oh, I'm psyched. It's been a long time coming.
You know, I read the book recently. It's great. I think it reminds me of Phil Knight's memoir, Shoe Dog. And I'll say it's like, a lot of people read business books. Like, I've got all the Ben Horowitz books on my book, on my bedside table. It's not really like a business book. It's a memoir. It's a very like personal story. I binge read it, if you will.
Yeah, which is appropriate, I guess, for a book about Netflix. No, I mean, that stuff you're saying is on purpose. You know, there's way too many business books. And originally, I was writing like a self-help book. I mean, back even further. So, you know, when I left Netflix, I spent 15 years working with early stage entrepreneurs and other people who weren't even entrepreneurs, but college students who all had these ideas they wanted to try. Mm-hmm. And the insight was that all the stuff that I've learned in 40 years as an entrepreneur is the exact same stuff that anybody could use.
Anybody.
Who has an idea.
Yeah.
Because a lot of these ideas aren't like, I'm going to start a company. A lot of them is, God, I would love to live in downtown, you know, in a nice neighborhood in San Francisco. How can I figure that out? I'd love to get that job. I'd love to, people have things they want to do,
right,
and they get blocked.
Just like goals.
Yeah, and I kind of realized the exact same startup methodology that I use for starting companies, anybody could use. But anyway, that was the original idea, was to write the self-helping book.
Yeah.
And wrote the proposal, solicited, sent it out to publishers, yeah. And a bunch of them were bidding for it. And then this one editor, guy who eventually is my editor, said, listen, I want to do this book, but I don't want to do the book you're proposing. I have a different idea. Huh. And he goes, it would be so much better if it wasn't a you book. Like, you should do this, you should do that.
Right.
You should make it a me book. Make that in other words, I do this. Make it a memoir.
Yeah.
He goes, make the lessons not explicit. Mm. Make them implicit.
Right.
So that was the idea, was to make this a story about what really goes on in a startup.
Yeah.
And you know, we were talking about it a few minutes ago, but it's so over glorified
now.
There's this cult of the entrepreneur, the CEO. Who, in a moment of inspiration, has the whole idea become clear and laid out in front of them. And then it's just a matter of all doing the pitch meetings and going to the parties and getting on Shark Tank and then doing.
Yeah.
And I'm going, no, it's not. You know, it's 20 years of grinding away and disappointment and fun and challenge and excitement and puzzles. And I wanted people to see that. And the other part of it, which is the fact that you've got to keep your marriage together. You've got to know your kids. You've got to keep yourself healthy.
Yeah.
You've got to recognize these other people all have lives.
Yeah.
And so anyway, I'm not getting ahead of myself.
Yeah, I definitely want to talk about that. Because
that's exactly what I was trying to create, which is why it's not. It's a long way of saying, I don't view it as a business book. I view it as a memoir.
It's great. I mean, I think it's much more personal. It tells the early days, which is, for our founders, those are the days we all look back on fondly, even though it's super painful and like lots of problems. But nobody, like, you know, I think that's one of the biggest things for me working early stage or starting a company versus like looking at big companies. You just don't have that same, like, I don't know, the same feeling, I guess, or the esprit de corps.
That's what it is. And I tried to capture that too.
Mm-hmm. I think it's also interesting because it's not necessarily a book about you, because you bring a lot of other players into this. And I think that's really important because we do have this cult of founder, Jesus founders, that one person can solve the problems and walk on water. But the reality is you pull the team together.
And which is, you need to.
Yeah.
I mean, ideas, you know, everyone thinks is one idea, but it's not. It's this huge mixture You know, one person has background in this, one person has this, one person had this problem, experienced this, and missing all, it's all those pieces together that end up solving the problem.
Yeah.
In fact, I think having a single person doing it is the wrong way to do it. They can't. It's mythical.
Yeah. Sorry to all the solo founders out there. And obviously with Netflix now, huge, huge company, one of the few companies I think have impacted the culture of the, not just the US, but the world.
Yeah.
How did that feel? Like you were the guy, like you came up with this thing in a carpool.
It's crazy. It's like out of body. You just, because when you start something, you are not ever envisioning this.
Yeah.
At least I wasn't. I mean, I'm thinking about for the first 6 months is how do we launch this thing?
Right.
And what you want to launch is just a rudimentary website. You're not thinking, okay, how am I going to begin thinking about Hollywood and about producing my own movies and expanding into, Ethiopia? You know, if you did, you'd never start,
right?
Because you go, there's no way we could do that. I'm going to go over the first hill,
yeah,
and then we'll look around and see where we are and see where we go next.
Yeah. That was interesting because one of the questions I have is kind of company culture. Everybody knows about the Netflix culture. Patty McCord is kind of famous in the HR recruiting world. But you purposely kept the company in Santa Cruz in the early days, right?
Tried to.
Instead of going over the hill.
Right.
And that drive on 17, you know, locals know it's a kind of treacherous drive in bad weather, but it's also just a terrible slog in traffic. So why Santa Cruz versus Sunnyvale?
There's a couple of reasons. And selfishly, because I lived in Santa Cruz.
Sure.
And it's the, you know, if you're in the valley, you understand. But if you're somewhere else, you have to realize that the jobs are all here in the valley.
Yeah.
And that people who don't want to live in the valley, you want to live over the mountains, mm-hmm, or the beach or in the woods, where I did, have this fantasy about, wouldn't it be great if I didn't need to start every day with an hour and 15 minutes in traffic and end every day the same way?
Yeah.
And so when I had the opportunity to start another company, I said, I'm going to do it here.
Right.
So there was this selfish thing. And at the same time, I really wanted the personal life flexibility that comes from having your work in the same place you live.
Even early on.
Especially early on. Because I knew that I'd be working like a dog.
Yeah.
You know, and by living there, I was able to, which I did, I go home at 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock, which is early.
Yeah.
But I'd be able to be there, I'd have dinner with my family, I'd, wow, put the kids to bed, and then I could go back to the office.
Wow.
On the weekend, I could just bike over and spend half a day there.
Yeah.
It was a sense of being connected that if I could get up in the morning, early on Sunday, go to the office, and then if my wife calls up and goes, hey, the kids just got up, we're all going to go, I go, great, I'll be home in 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And there's something to be said for that connection.
Oh, I think it's huge. I do that with my kids, and I didn't know too many people that do that. So I say I work two shifts. So I'll do like, you know, the 9 to 6, and then I'll be home. I have dinner with my kids every night. And then when they go to bed at 9, I start my second shift. So
yeah.
I work from like 9 to 2,
yeah,
in the morning. But like, I don't know a lot of people that do that.
They should.
So,
no, I agree. Yeah. That's again, it's part of what you want to illustrate,
right?
Because there is, again, it's trying to defeat this myth,
yeah,
that the successful founder is the one who is married to their job.
Right.
And that's all they think about and all they do. I mean, I just finished reading Super Pumped. I mean, that's pathetic,
yeah,
in my opinion.
Well,
for a bunch of different reasons. Yeah. But I mean, even earlier on, this whole issue of it's work all the time, all the time, all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of wanted to demonstrate it is possible to build something with some balance in your life.
Mm. So yeah, let's talk about the Netflix culture. Freedom and responsibility is a big one. I think radical honesty, everybody talks about radical candor nowadays, but it feels like it's a spin-off of radical honesty. The acronym I came up with is Freedom and Responsibility is FAR. Does it come a lot from your camping trips when you were younger?
Not explicitly. I mean, certainly I internalized it from all the time that I spent in that manner. And so, I mean, I should explain, I guess, what that means. But you know, when you're out in the woods or in the mountains, especially, there's huge degrees of uncertainty and invisibility. I mean, the very nature of risk is not necessarily that it's scary and dangerous, but it's the risk that I don't know what's around the corner,
right?
And I'm going to find out not by sitting back and trying to figure out how to see it. I'm just going to walk on the trail and see what I see. And so when you're with a group, you have to be prepared. Okay, there's a river. Or you knew there was a river, but oh my gosh, it's in flood stage. You have to then improvise.
Right.
And so a lot of the times you have something, you'll give people independent responsibilities. And you'll say, I'll meet you there in 2 weeks on the top of that peak. And I want you to have all these things done. And the person who has responsibility of carrying all the gear, they've got to make decisions on what is required. They can't cross the river easily.
Right.
The people who have this different objective, they can go fast. So everyone basically solves the problem on their own.
Mm-hmm.
That's the freedom part. But the responsibility is I expect you to be there.
Right.
And that happens all the time in the mountains. So I became used to that style of leadership and that style of group working.
Mm-hmm.
And the cool thing is we've got a startup, as you know, it's always like that.
Yeah.
There just aren't enough people.
Right.
I mean, you have 10 people to do the work of 100. So there is not time to say, okay, what I want you to do is today, do this and this. And if it doesn't work, you got to change to this. And then in 3 days, no, you just go, you see that peak? I'll meet you there in 3 weeks.
Yeah.
And you better have the stuff. And,
right.
And more times than not, you'll show up on the top of the peak and you'll be bruised and be bloody. But it'll be on time, you'll open the bag and all the shit's in there.
Yeah.
And I don't need to worry about you going, oh, the river was in flood stage. I didn't, you figured it out.
Right.
That's the freedom and the responsibility is there. And all startups have that. But what happens is when they get bigger, so you go from 10 to 100 people, you make mistakes in hiring.
Yeah.
And now someone shows up late and you go, ooh, we can't let this happen. Everyone check in once a week.
Mm-hmm.
Give me a status report. And then one person shows up and he goes, I had to spend all this extra money. And we go, oh, can't have that.
Yeah.
Everybody, I want approvals for any expenses over $100. And what you've done is built these guardrails around the one person who doesn't have judgment,
right,
and end up frustrating the other 99.
Yeah.
So the big Netflix experiment was, is it possible to have freedom and responsibility like we had when we were 10 people,
mm-hmm,
when we have not just 100, but 1,000 of them, or like now 7,000?
Yeah.
And that's really hard. Mm-hmm. And the nature of it is that you have to hire well, but more importantly, you can't hire well.
Mm-hmm.
You have to cut efficiently.
Yeah,
because not everyone has judgment to play in that. But they said we're going to build a company that doesn't protect us against people without good judgment. We're going to build a company for people with good judgment.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned, I can't remember whether it was part of this or not part, about how hard it is to recruit someone away from Netflix.
Yeah.
It's because we realized that the most important component in why someone wants to work someplace is being treated like an adult.
Mm-hmm.
But the worst thing you can do is say, you've got a $50 million nut, but I don't trust you to make a decision about what class of car rental you can do.
Right.
Or you can't seem to decide when it's appropriate to fly to Japan on business class because you've got a meeting in the morning,
mm-hmm,
or whether you can go coach because your meeting isn't for 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, treat them up, you know, that's what Netflix has done so well.
Yeah.
Is build this culture for people with great judgment. And surprise, surprise, people love that.
Yeah. I'm not surprised, but the judgment thing comes from that you trusted them to do the right thing because to those people, it's their company too.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah.
So of course they're going to do the right thing.
You know, the Netflix, you know, there's no travel policy, and there's no expense policy, and there's no vacation policy. And the policy is use your best judgment.
Right.
Because treat the money like it was your own.
Yeah.
Treat the company like it's your own.
And we should really, I mean, shout out to Patty McCord because a lot of the stuff that she put in place is now kind of Silicon Valley standard. But back then it was really kind of like off the wall. Like, this is crazy. I remember my first job, I had an unlimited vacation policy. I was like, that's crazy. Why are you doing this?
Well, we were lucky because the thing is, the things I described happening when you go from 10 to 100 happened to me. Mm-hmm. And I let it slip. Mm-hmm. And what got us back on track is we had, had to do a layoff, back after the dot-com collapse, going through the valley of death there. We had to lay off 40% of the company, and it got us back, didn't even realize it until after the fact, back to that feeling of there's not enough people, everyone's empowered, everyone has the freedom to solve this problem as you need to, with the responsibility to get it done. And we went, wow, this feels great.
Yeah.
And that's when we said we can't ever lose this feeling. And that's when Patty McCord began taking me even further.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what else are we doing which is getting in the way of someone feeling like an adult?
Right.
And that's when she goes, let's get rid of this.
Yeah.
And the lawyers and the HR, no. She goes, okay, let's just try it. And if it doesn't work, we'll put it back.
Yeah.
And it works,
Yeah, so the idea of experimentation was still alive and well.
Absolutely right.
But earlier, you actually had a meeting with Amazon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Tell me about that.
So this was early. This was probably 2 months after we launched.
Wow.
Before we raised our first venture round.
Mm-hmm.
So we were still running on our friends and family.
Okay.
And we got the call. Got the call from Joy Covey, who was the CFO of Amazon at the time. And the call was basically, hey, Jeff would love to meet you guys. Can you come on up to Seattle?
And you go.
We're going like, yeah. And for two reasons. I mean, one, Jeff Bezos was like, not even a god then, but he was like this guy who was almost single-handedly inventing e-commerce at the time. I mean, the company had gone public.
Mm-hmm.
It was like the most unbelievable success story.
It went public really fast too.
Yeah, really fast. Because it got to, revenues ramped up like crazy real quickly. But he was only doing books. But he had this hubris to say that he wasn't going to be just a bookstore. He was going to be the everything store.
Yes.
And it was pretty obvious the next category would be music and video. Packaged good commodity entertainment. So we go, wow, he wants to buy us. Which was unbelievable. Because I mean, the book is called Down Over Work. Because that is what every single person told me.
Yes.
And so
hundreds of people told Jeff too.
Yeah, of course. And to have Jeff Bezos, the pioneer of e-commerce, want to buy us is incredibly validating. His opinion counted more than 100 people who said that. And so we fly up. But it was a really jarring experience because Reed and I were navigating by a printed out MapQuest map. I don't know if you remember.
Yes,
this is before you had, before cell phones, before GPS. We're printed out and we're in this neighborhood and people are shooting up in a doorway and the windows are broken and there's garbage. And I'm going, this is where the pioneer e-commerce has their headquarters? And then we get up and it's a dusty storefront window. We're looking in and you're going upstairs and there's boxes piled on the stairs and pizza boxes and not even a receptionist. And you go in and people are squeezed in under the stairs and all the desks are made of doors. They're made of old recycled doors where they take the doorknob out and patch it with a plug of wood and put them on four legs. And Reed and I are looking around, can't believe this place. And then we met Jeff, and it was, I so remember it because I remember him and I were sharing these startup stories, and I could almost see his whole mean, how do you pronounce that? Mean? See, that's a weird thing. I've read it a million times. I read that say it. His whole face changes, right? And because as he was reliving this feeling, now he's a big company, public company, then he was like starting up. Because both of us had rigged up a bell to ring when an order came in.
Right.
We were shared in that.
Right.
But anyway, it was great. And eventually, we had a great meeting. On the way out, Joy walks us out. And she goes, listen, this could be interesting, but I've got to set expectations. This is probably going to be, maybe a low eight-figure,
That's all?
Yeah. And that, which is, and that basically, low eight-figure means barely eight figures, which means probably 10.
10 to 12.
Yeah. So we said, okay, maybe it's $15 million.
Right.
And I'm the third of the company then. So That was pretty good for a year.
Yeah.
But it was this perfect time where we had figured out what we thought were all the hard things. We had built this website. We'd gotten a single copy of every single DVD available. I'd gotten these deals with the consumer electronics companies. We had the money. We'd launched, and we hadn't yet realized how shitty an idea it was. So at this time, we go, we're not ready to hand the keys to Jeff Bezos just yet.
But that's good, because you believe that your company was more valuable, or had a very clear path to being much more valuable.
We wanted to see where this went. But what ultimately, the thing that ultimately won was the no due dates, no late fees.
Yeah.
And was that was nothing like anyone had ever seen in video rental before. What kind of video rental store lets you take the movie and keep it for as long as you want it? And not only that, doesn't charge you every time you exchange, but has a subscription.
Yeah.
So we turned this whole thing upside down in its head. But it wasn't like I woke up one morning and went, no due dates, no late fees,
yeah,
subscription. I certainly didn't do it back in 1997. It took 2 years of trial and error and experimentation.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just one thing we tried, which was as likely to work as anything else was.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So that's why I think what's beautiful now is that people have an idea, at least a web idea, that an internet idea.
Yeah.
You can figure out some clever way to try it. It doesn't involve actually building it or doing it.
Right.
And that's what's great about it. You find out so quickly. No barrier.
It's very cheap to test these days.
Exactly.
But the IPO was a great moment for you, and your son was on the plane with you.
Yeah, it was somewhat anticlimactic in a way, because you know that image of like the ticker tape and the people ringing the bell and everyone cheering? Well, that's the New York Stock Exchange.
Of course.
Wrong exchange. So NASDAQ takes place in some computer server someplace, the actual opening.
Yeah.
But we did it on the trading floor of the Merrill Lynch, who was underwriting our stock. And so we were there watching them match trades, match prices, which is about as exciting as watching the inside of a server.
I did that job.
Yeah.
I was a market maker.
Yeah.
There you go. It's not exciting at all.
And I was there in New York on the trading floor. I had my 10-year-old son with me, Logan.
Yeah.
And I was doing the play-by-play announcing to the people back in Los Gatos who gathered at 6:30 in the morning to hear us go public. But it was pretty cool because it happened. And then Logan and I were free for the day before we flew back to California. But I remember I was in the taxi and I was taking him to get a slice of famous raise. He'd been hearing me bitch about how bad California pizza was for too long. I had to get him a slice of New York pizza.
Yeah.
And somehow that was the perfect thing to do when all of a sudden I was pretty wealthy.
Yeah.
It's almost immediately. But it was this very out-of-body thing to be in the cab and going, God, I don't need to work again if I don't want to. But
it's amazing.
But I kind of, I'm doing this because I want to do it.
Yeah.
And then rather than going out to a fancy steak dinner, him and I went and got greasy pizza on paper plates, and I can think of nothing better.
That's such a great story. And like, yeah, one day I'll take my kid to the trading floor.
Good. I hope you do.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Great. Thank you very much, Mark, for making the time. This has been amazing.
This was really fun
with you.
I'm really glad I had a chance to do it.
Yeah, definitely pick up the book. It's definitely going to be a bestseller. I think it's one of the best startup story books out there. If you love this stuff like we do, go get it.
See, I think your next series has got to be like a version of Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee.
Yes.
It's got to be Entrepreneurs on Bikes.
That's what I'm saying.
That's
what I originally pitched.
And the two of us, I forget it.
It's too hard to do it with the cameras and the sound. That's definitely the way. All right.
We have some photos with you.
Yeah.
That was awesome.
That was really good. That was a great podcast. So I hope it works for you. Thank you.